And in trying to tell my readers something about homesteading without absolutely openly cramming it down their throats, I have invented an immigrant guide for this book. And so my characters refer to it every so often. They brought it with them from Scotland. It's Crowfoot's Atlantic Immigrant's Guide. And so they look to Crowfoot every so often. Crowfoot writes in a high-blown, even more so than me, he writes in a kind of a high-blown 19th century style. And so here is my narrator looking back at Crowfoot and doing some of his own thinking as he and his chum Rob are homesteading up in the Two Medicine Country in 1890. First of all, this is from my narrator, the first couple sentences. God proctored poor dim old Job about how the measures of the earth were laid. Had Job but been a homesteader, he could have readily answered that the government of the United States of America did it. And now from Crowfoot. The vast public domain westward of the Mississippi River, as Crowfoot put the matter for us when Rob and I were somewhere back there on his oceanic border from emigration to immigration, Crowfoot again, where the stalwart homesteader may obtain legal title to his land claim by 5 years of living upon it and improving it with his building and husbandry labors, has been summed in an idea as simple as it is powerful. The land has been made into arithmetic. This is to say, surveyors have established governing lineations across the earth. I've explained all that already, so I'm going to skip along through Crowfoot a little bit. As can be seen, the continuousness of the numeration is reminiscent of the Boustrophedon pattern a farmer makes as he plows back and forth the furrows of his field, or indeed, of the alternate directions in which earliest Greek is written. Thus does the originality of the American experiment, the ready granting of land to those industrious enough to seek it, emulate old efficacious patterns. Thus endeth Crowfoot. My narrator goes on. Rob's remark at the time was that Crowfoot himself verged on the Greek here. But upon the land itself, there on the great earthen table of the American experiment, the survey system's lines of logic wrote themselves out so clearly they took your breath away. Why wasn't the rest of humankind's ledger this orderly? Filing our homestead claims of 160 acres apiece, the allowable amount one person could choose out of a square mile section of 640 acres, amounted merely to finding section line markers, making the journey to the land office at Lewistown, putting a finger on the registrar's map and saying, this quarter section is the patch of earth that will be mine. The land had been made into arithmetic indeed. On the declaration of applicant, there in front of me, my land's numbers were registered as the southwest quarter section, section 31, township 28 north, range 8 west. At Rob's, they were the northeast quarter section, section 32, same township, same range. With our grins at each other, we agreed that ink had never said anything better. And now a bit of reality begins to creep in the next paragraph of my narrator. Here then is land, just that, land, naked earth skin. And now the due sum. From this minute on, the next 5 years of your life, please, invested entirely into this chosen square of earth of yours. Put upon it house, outbuildings, fences, garden, a well, livestock, haystacks, performing every bit of this at once and irrespective of weather and wallet, and if you have ever laid hand to any of these tasks before. Build before you can plan. Build in your sleep and through your mealtimes, but build, pilgrim. Build, claimant of the earth. Build, build, build. You are permitted to begin in the kind delusion that your utensils of homestead making at least are the straightforward ones. Axe, hammer, adze, pick, shovel, pitchfork. But your true tools are other. The nearest names that can be put to them are hope, muscle, and time. Thank you. Thank you. Okay, I'd be glad to handle questions for 20 minutes or so. If we've got that many questions, if not, we can all go home. Questions? Some questions? Yeah.
This is really a question, but it's just something that I think back on a lot. My dad and I had a homestead at Brady. You probably know where that is.
Yes, indeed. Yeah.
We lived west of Brady. And in the 30s, we got hailed out and things weren't going good. So he said he was going to get rid of the farm. Well, I loved that place. And I used to sit on the rocks and look at the sky and all this. Really loved it. So every time a fire would come, I'd run out behind the barn and say, "Please God, don't let them buy this place." So he asked me years later, he said, "Isn't that funny?" I said, "You don't know what God and I were doing up on that same farm." His grandson was farmer of the year 2 years ago, so God evidently knew that was a good
We place. Toast that homestead success story. Yeah. Very nice. Thanks for letting us all know that. Also, what a great book title, What God and I Were Doing Out Behind the Barn.
Yeah, it is.
You know, I'll give you a couple of fingers for that title. Okay. Next, please, anything.
Why don't you talk about the background of the name of your latest book?
Okay, this will be the third time Norma Ashby has heard today the name of the background of the name of my book. Incidentally, we forgot to plug your Sunday show at 10. When the second interview is on.
He reads some more from his book, excuse
me. Yeah, right. Okay, Dancing at the Rascal Fair. In the Scotland that my characters came from in the late 1880s, there's an old tradition of hiring fairs. Any of you who have read, I discovered after I was doing all this, any of you who have read Far from the Madding Crowd, may remember a very small scene in there where Gabriel Oak is at a hiring fair somewhere down in the south of England. Well, there was a similar tradition in Scotland. The hiring fairs were a bit not as elaborate as county fairs, but there was singing, dance, and no doubt a drop of drink once in a while. And the farmers and the farm workers would gather in the town squares of these small Scottish places, small Scottish towns and cities, and bargain out the summer's wages and terms of employment. Will I get St. Swithin's Day off or something? And will I get homegoing day? And will you pay me if we work past sunset or something like that? And so all this bargaining went on, and things were more or less settled year by year. I look on it much as my dad hiring his haying crews when he was a haying contractor in this country. But human nature being what it is, there were always some hard cases on either side. People whose word didn't hold up in a bargain or who were very hard bargainers in the first place, and so there were some leftovers, and the leftovers had to work with each other, and this was called the Rascal Fair. The rascals, the people you really wouldn't want to buy a used car from, I think. And so I came across this in a book my wife found in Glasgow or Edinburgh, a book called something like Social Class in Scotland. And it was a book which, a sociology book really, and it simply was very dry and academic and analytical about who the farm laborers were and, you know, what the basis of the wages was and on. But in the midst of all this dry stuff was this sentence or two about the Rascal Fair. And so I read that. I was about a third of the way into the writing of this book, the first draft or whatever, and didn't really have a title for the book, and so I went to bed one night after reading this and got up the next morning and told Carol, well, a couple pieces of news. I slept hardly at all last night, and the title of the book apparently is going to be Dancing at the Rascal Fair, because I was thinking about it all night. And to have that title, to justify that title, I felt I then needed a very ancient Scottish tune, which I had to write, of course. And so I went out, bought a songwriter's rhyming book. They're quite wonderful. If any of you are interested in poetry or songwriting, they give you all the possible rhymes. All you have to do is look up the vowels, and they give you the endings that rhyme with other endings. And so out of that I wrote, I don't know, I ended up writing, it must be 8 or 10 verses of this Dancing at the Rascal Fair, which are scattered through this book. And just to give you a quick sample, and I won't sing it, but the first verse, the rhythm of it is, Dancing at the Rascal Fair, devils and angels all were there, heel and toe, pair by pair, dancing at the Rascal Fair. Now, any of you who have done any poetry know that all I've done is make that scan, doing the rhythms. But you get into some of the damnedest things when you try to be inventive. On October 17th, I'm going to be in St. Paul reading from Dancing at the Rascal Fair on the successor radio show to Prairie Home Companion. And the other news is that it's probably going to stop at the Minnesota borders. It's on Minnesota Public Radio, and I don't think it's going to be broadcast nationally. It's a kind of a preview show, as far as I know so far. But in any event, I'm going to be on this on Noah Adams' new show back there, reading from a dance scene in the book, which has a couple of verses, the dancing of the Rascal Fair song. And I'm to be on there with, I don't know, the Kentucky Wonder String Band or something. And they're to provide the music. And so here came the inquiry from St. Paul. Well, what is the music to Dancing at the Rascal Fair? Well, you're right to laugh, because I had to write back and say, I don't know, I just do words. And so indeed, it's up to the Kentucky Wonders. We'll see how wonderful they are. Okay, very long answer to that.
And I think some of my favorite parts of your book are your descriptions of the wonderful 2 one-room schoolhouses that your main character teaches in, and his love teaches in the other one. Are those a combination of many, many people that you talk to, or from some of your own experience with one-room schoolhouses?
Time for a confession. I never went to a one-room schoolhouse. Consolidation was the word of the day when I was a kid, and so I very much wish I'd had the chance to go to a one-room schoolhouse some of those years. I was always packed into town and boarded with somebody or put on a bus and rode and rode and rode. And so I did not have the experience of the one-room school myself. My father did, and my mother did. And what Norma's talking about in the experiences of the children, one of the things in there, it is set up by a lack of Montana geography books, and so one of the teachers has the students make their own little Montana geography books. Make it out of colored paper. One page is industries of Montana, another is agriculture of Montana, done by about fourth graders, I guess. Things are colored in, little mountains are put in. I have my mother's from Mausaugun, and I could not resist using that. I should explain that these are shaped like the state of Montana. It's scissored down in the face profile of the state of Montana, each of these little books they did at Mausaugun. And so that was one instance of the one-room school coming on, staying on in history and speaking directly to me. I gathered material also from a very fortunate happenstance down in the Billings country. Several years ago, it may be as much as 10 or 15 now, maybe some of you will know about this, there was staged what was called the Tri-City Reunion down there. And of course, you'll know what the Tri-Cities were: Ingomar, Van Anda, and Sumatra. And 1,000 people came back. 1,000 people who had been on homesteads down in that country came back to that reunion. Well, they did something in producing their book, their reminiscent book of that occasion, which I wish to God every centennial book done in this state had done. They put in the names and addresses of everybody who was there. And so a friend out on the coast who was originally from Ingomar pointed this out to me. I don't think he told me the addresses were in the book. He simply gave me the book, and I was leafing through. I've seen, you know, geez, I've seen 50 or 60 of these things, I think, in the, my research on this state. You know, and I was plodding through the back, and here were these addresses. And all of a sudden, I saw the possibilities. And so I hired a friend to word process some letters for me to some of these people and saying, I have a list of questions about what it was like to be a kid out on those homesteads, to go to school, what the schools were like. If you rode a horse, what did you do with the horse when you got to school? You know, was there sagebrush around you picking them too? Did the daddies of the community build a hitch rail, a barn? What went on? Well, I got a very nice set of responses and was able to learn a lot from that. And so, consequently, my schoolhouse in the book, the one my narrator teaches in, has pictures of Abraham Lincoln and George Washington facing each other. Every so often they kind of tip towards each other as if they're confiding, and then it'll be straightened back and look reasonably sober again for a while. And details of this sort, anyway, came out of that. So, indeed, that experience of talking with people was a very potent one for me in writing this book, yeah. Got time for a couple more. Yeah. You look like you're from Valier.
Dean. I want to comment that you handled the matter of the outhouse very nicely.
Thank you. That is high praise, Gene. Okay.
The female side of it was always under attack.
Yeah, okay. Gene is, this is Gene Bonnet, one of my longtime friends from Valier. And he's complimenting me on my finesse in handling an outhouse scene. And you may recall, any of you who read English Crick, there was an outhouse scene in that too. And so this is not really coincidental. It's going to be an outhouse scene in the 1989 book of some kind. I don't know what kind. But it seems to me a big part of life. And so what took place here in Dancing at the Rascal Fair, as Gene said, I describe the schoolhouse and the two pertinent similarly white-painted receptacles behind it as an educational trinity. That all three of those buildings were necessities, of course. And as Gene points out, and he's probably speaking from experience, the girls' share of those three buildings was under, as he says, constant attack from prank-playing boys. I took that and wrote a scene in it, and I want to say, want to defend myself to the women of the audience that I did stick up for the female side of things by having Susan Duff, one of my favorite characters in this book, when a boy plants a garter snake in that outhouse, she picks it up, takes it out, finds it in the schoolyard, and hits him across the bridge of the nose with it. Anything further? We're certainly getting into bigger and better topics here.
You talk a lot about the hardships, but you balance that by talking about the fun the people had in that era. And I think a lot of us grew up with some of the memories, and you mentioned that you remember some of the old early day dances and things that you went through.
Yeah. Probably the dancing part of the title is not coincidental in this book either. Strangely, it rather stopped with me because I'm not really a dancer, although I love music. It tends to be folk music. I like words even in my music. But my parents were fanatic dancers, as were their grandparents, as best I can gather. And so I've taken that fact, and along with an outhouse scene in each book, there's going to be a big dance in each of these three books. And in Dancing at the Rascal Fair, it is a schoolhouse dance in a place called Scotch Heaven, where they are primarily Scottish people and they are doing schottisches and so on. But if you look carefully, my narrator in this book at one of those early dances is taught a square dance, one called Bunch to the Middle, that, which if you look carefully into English Greek, his grandson, Jick McCaskill, witnesses some 50 years later. And so I'm trying for this kind of continuity of the gaiety that also attended life. And there are some details of that. I don't know if they're marks of character or not, but one of the more interesting things I ever learned about my own family, the Doig family, my dad's generation, when I was researching this House of Sky, a woman who was of my dad's generation, indeed had been to those dances, danced with him and so forth, said, well, I hope you'll have something in there about how those Doigs could dance and how they went about things. And I should explain briefly that my dad was one of what were called the Doig boys. There were these five brothers, not all that far apart in age, and they, being thoughtful Scots, they married late in life. And so for many years, the Ringling 16 White Sulphur Country had put up with these Doig boys at the dance. And I said, well, Eleanor, tell me something about that. How, you know, what was special about them? She said, well, what really impressed me was that after the dance, we would dance into the early hours in those days, the Doig boys would go home, get home 4 or 5 in the morning, 3, 4 or 5 in the morning, and they'd do the chores and then go to bed. And rather than going to bed for a couple hours and then trying to get up after that and face the chores. And so they simply kind of went on momentum, as I gather it, and probably some fairly surprised cows were milked during some of that, but they kind of put everything into one package was the description. So, and I have in this book, if you have a setting that you're trying to work with, you can then work on the details. Well, what was it like? What do you want to have? Who does the square dance calls? And so I concocted a guy in English Creek who did the square dance calls, and this time I have a left-handed fiddler. For instance, I have a left-handed family that runs through this book. Everybody in it is left-handed, and so so this guy is turns out to be their fiddler. You know, unlikely as it is, there he is. So, so the dancing, the gaiety, I've tried not to neglect at least. So, yes. I thought about the future of Montana. Well, I try, as all of you do. I don't have conclusions to offer here tonight, let me tell you. But it's the kind of work I'm doing in that I do draw so much on what has happened. I am a guy who works from history, from the past, and so forth. And I don't think that makes me into any kind of great prophet. And so, you know, I can't tell you, I'm sorry to say, what I think the future of Montana is going to be. It is illuminating, of course, to come back a couple, three times a year as I do and see how things are going, see the changes and so forth. And there of course have been some trends evident down through the years of the decline of downtowns, perhaps the homogenization of Montanans, people who didn't have radios now have satellite dishes, people's parents at least who didn't have radios have satellite dishes, and on and on. So I don't know whether we're Montanans are becoming more and more like Americans or not. Other Americans, I should say. The other people of America. There is a notion that television is going to homogenize all our speech. We're all going to talk like what used to be said, Walter Cronkite. I don't know who it would be now. There's a guy who does Nightline. Anyway, Ted Koppel. But I don't find that particularly in talking with people out here. It seems to me there is the language, at least, I think, retains a lot of its own tang out here. Culture does. I don't know if you've got boots on who asked me that question or not, but I do direct your attention to what I'm wearing. given to me, you know, a Great Falls Centennial belt buckle, given to me by none other than the hostess here tonight. I mean, you can tell. I'm traveling around some this year, and I can tell when I'm in Montana and when I'm in Oregon. yet. So I think there is some distinctiveness, a lot of distinctiveness out here yet. The economic questions are great major ones I'm not going to get into tonight. So anyway, yes, I am trying to get some kind of fix on these, on modern Montana, and I will be doing so across the next couple of years traveling around, but mine will be simply one person's opinion, kind of an eccentric one, because I have a lot of things I want to drag in for fictional purposes to tell a story rather than to prophesy. Yeah?
Any comment or observations on the ethnic gravitation to certain areas?
Well, that's part of what I hope will be researched down to the last detail. The question is about the ethnic gravitation in homesteading, you mean?
Yes.
Yeah. I can't really say much here tonight. I don't think that makes a lot of detailed sense. But we do know that, you know, there were a bunch of Danes went over by, what, Dagmar, I guess. And I do recall that when I was a kid and would go down to visit my grandmother, Bessie Ringer, she's down in the Shields River country by the Crazies. The Irish, the people around there, this is in the early 50s, when you visited that area, it was about like going to Norway. Seriously, a lot of old Norwegians down there. A lot of people did group together, and of course the almost entirely Scottish grouping of my own ancestors in the Turney Basin in the Big Belts. How and why this happened, I don't know a lot about. The Scotch I have studied, they tended to, the problem is finding the first guy, why he went, because then they would tend to follow, that he would ride home and a brother would come, and then maybe a sister and brother-in-law, as you know, that's roughly what happened in my family. Word would come back, and there would be this long kind of rope bridge of people coming. It didn't always happen that way, as those of us from Valier know. Belgians came in a colony, I guess trainloads at a time. It's a very rich, diverse history, and the problem with it is that there were so many homesteads and so many people, and it's all there out there in raw numbers rather than sophisticated history. Yes, ma'am, way at the back. Yeah.
And we hope that to grow into a search of or trying to identify who these people were and where they came from. We are getting the names and their locations of their homesteads and their land that they settled on, but it will take us quite a bit longer to locate where they came from.
Mm-hmm.
And if anybody can help us with that, we should appreciate help.
Yeah, anybody with information on homesteading can pitch in on some of this, even here tonight possibly, with the Historical Society people.
We have over 7,200 patent holders in the county, and so we have a lot of names to look for.
This is what? One of 56 counties, right, in this state. So that, you know, it gives you a notion of the colossal amount of research to be done before we can get a big picture of Montana homesteading. So, well, I'm going to thank you all for listening here. I'll be glad to meet you in the signing in the area back here, sign books if you want or whatever. But in the meantime, thanks very much for coming out tonight.
I want to thank you again, Mr. Doig. We all, I'm sure, everyone learned something and appreciate your sharing. Our homestead researcher, Mary Melander, will also be in the room with Mr. Doig. She'll have a few of her plat map samples in case you want to see what type of research she's doing. There's also refreshments, and of course, Mr. Doig will be in there with his books in case you want to purchase a book. Again, thank you all for coming. We hope to see you at another program soon. Good night. I'd like to thank you all for coming this evening. It's so good to see all of you and to know that there are so many people interested in finding out more about how life was and the truths that lay with it. My name is Cindy Adams, and I'm the curator for the Cascade County Historical Society. If you are already a member, we're really glad that you're here and are supporting your membership. If you have not yet joined us, do consider. We would love to have you be one of us. After the program, we will have refreshments, and Mr. Doig will be signing books in this room off to the right here. There will also be exhibits open downstairs, and our gift shop is also open downstairs if you want to just wander around the halls and see what is in Paris Gibson Square. We invite you to do so. At this time, I'd like to introduce Mrs. Norma Ashby, and she is going to carry on from here.
Thank you very much, Cindy. When Ivan Doig called me several weeks ago to tell me he would be in Great Falls to autograph copies of his latest book, in addition to booking him for my noon news program and my weekend program, Perspective on Great Falls, the next thing I thought about was booking him for the Cascade County Historical Society so that all of us who love his work could have an opportunity to hear him firsthand talk about his work and, best of all, ask him questions and perhaps get him to autograph a copy of his work for us. Ivan Doig is a remarkable friend and a remarkable Montanan. As a lot of you know, he was born in White Sulphur Springs, grew up on a sheep ranch near DuPuyer, graduated from Valier High School, received his first degree from Northwestern, and then received his PhD in history from the University of Washington. He's been working full-time at his writing, and he said what enables him to do that is his wife is a journalism teacher at a college in Seattle. So she brings in that steady paycheck and allows him to work, write as many as 800 words a day to contribute to all of our wealth of literature. I just want to talk briefly about his three Montana books that we're all familiar with. He's written others, but it's the three Montana books that I think are nearest and dearest to our hearts. The first one was in 1978, This House of Sky, which won many, many awards, including a nomination for the National Book Award. And then in 1984, he began his trilogy with English Creek. And again, it was nominated and received a lot of national awards, including an award from the National Cowboy Hall of Fame in Oklahoma City. And now he brings us Dancing at the Rascal Fair, which deals with the homesteading era from 1889, starting when Montana became a state, up until the beginning of World War I, about 1920. And he tells us he's already working on the third of the trilogy, which will be taking place in our centennial of year, 1989. And we can look forward to getting that in 1990. So hopefully we can all be back together again in 1990 for a repeat evening. I'll just read one statement by one of the many reviewers that have commented about Ivan's work. He says, Ivan's many admirers won't be disappointed in Dancing at the Rascal Fair. He just gets better and better. And having read the book already, I can assure you that is true. Tonight he's going to be talking with us about homesteading, which he covers in his book, and then he will talk specifically about some of the things in his book, and finally he will be looking forward to answering your questions. Let's give a warm Great Falls and Montana welcome to Ivan Doig.
Thank you, Norma. Can you hear me at the way at the back of the room? Okay. I noticed in the Sunday Tribune, a guy has written a book, What to Do on a Boring Day in Great Falls. Was I on that list? Is that why you're all here? Also in the Tribune, the newspaper notice seems to have been slightly inaccurate. It said I was going to talk about homesteading. It should have read something about I'm going to talk about how little I know about homesteading. Even after spending 3 years writing a novel about homesteaders. It is a colossal topic, huge even here in Montana, because Montana was one of the most homesteaded states. And in thinking tonight how to talk for maybe 20 minutes or so and do a bit of reading to you here before I take your questions, it seemed to me that I ought to talk both about the homesteads, the places, and about the paperwork, the sources of looking back at homesteading. If I savvy what is going on with the Cascade County Historical Society, it's a marvelous effort, and I'd like to try share with you some of the ways I've used the paperwork of homesteading. But the places first. In my case, I come from a homestead a couple of generations ago. My Scottish grandparents came into the Big Belt Mountains between White Sulphur and Townsend in the late 1880s. And I can remember my own first glimpse of the homestead my father was born on. It was in the late 1940s. My dad was contracting hay somewhere under Grass Mountain near the 16 country where he was born and raised. As happens with haying, something broke. And he remembered that over on the old place, the old Peter Doig place, his father's place, there was, I think, an old dump rake, as I recall it. And so one day, to get haying going again, he and I took off in the old Ford pickup to go over there and bring that dump rake back. I must have been 8 or 9 years old. And I remember it was the first time I saw my father cry from looking at a place. And I've seen that happen and heard of it happening time and again. We had a family reunion several years later back in there. And there were a lot of tears that day. But to see my father, who had grown up in a family of six on that homestead with all the scenery you could eat, Wall Mountain, a spectacular view from the living room of that homestead, and yet they had all starved out. All the Scots who settled in that basin, there wasn't a damn one of them left after World War II. There had been, my dad went to a one-room school, I think, with 36 fellow students. There were 12 or 15 families in there. None of them lasted. The country was very high, 5,500 feet back in there, terrible winters. And so it was not a very promising place to start with. And yet, the fact that the years had been put into it made a very strong tug on my dad's heart when he was about my age, I remember. At the family reunion, people particularly commented on the loss of timber on the hillsides up there, and that it was no longer the country where the grandparents had come to. Well, I think you can multiply my experience almost any number of times, certainly here in Montana, probably among this crowd here tonight. And yet, I want to give not a word of warning or advice or anything, I think a word of hope to those of you in Cascade County as you work on the homesteading past of this area. I would urge you to respect the emotions, the heritage behind homesteading, but I'd also urge you not to glorify it too much. People, by and large, let's face it, the homesteaders whom we are descended from, most of us, by and large, those people didn't come in by covered wagon, fight off the Indians with one hand, and run a ripping plow with the other. The actuality is that many of them, maybe even most of them in Montana's history, it was most of them, got off a train. The high tide of homesteading in Montana, this is not particularly well known elsewhere in the world, but the high tide of homesteading in Montana, by the research of Professor Richard Rader, was during World War I. That's pretty late to be thinking of a frontier, but that's when people flooded in here in particular. And so they would often get off a train, maybe be met by an early automobile, possibly were steered to their land by a land locator. And any of you interested in perhaps the family past, I would recommend to you Professor Bill Farr's piece several years ago in the Montana Magazine of History. Bill Farr's interview with George Solid, who was a land locator up here at Dutton. And there's some wonderful pictures in there of a sign as big as the end of this room saying, "George Solid, land locator." And then he has a big old, I don't know, touring car, Buick or something, take you directly to your homestead. So I hope there will be an awareness that this late frontier in Montana had a lot of the seeds of the future in it. It had automobiles. It had a lot of things which were coming, as well as a lot of things out of the past. I'd also like to say that it seems to me that, as I talk to them at least, the Montana historians who are trying to understand this state's homestead past, they and me, as a writer, and other writers trying to deal with this, we need to know some very basic things. A lot of the research has not been done on homesteading. We know that it happened. We have the totals of homesteads taken up in the land registers, things of that sort. But we need to know things like, who were these homesteaders? What were their nationalities? What states did they come from primarily? We need to know why they came. Why'd they leave the old place for a new place? Well, Jim Hill is one answer, of course, with the railroad, railroad promotion and so on. We need to know how many were in the families. Most of all, we need to know how long did they stay. I wanted to find out something about that tonight, in fact. In an audience like this, it's an opportunity I really can't pass up. So I wonder how many here in the audience tonight are from some kind of homestead background. How many of you here? Okay, can we take a rough count? Here's 5, 10, 15, 20, 25, 30, 35 or 40 in this hall tonight. Okay, next question. How many of you are still on or have the land, the family land, homesteaded by your ancestors? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, I think. Yeah. Not bad, not bad. That's roughly 20%. It makes the point, of course, that homesteads worked, in a sense, or we wouldn't be here, in that it gave our ancestors a place to light. But maybe it didn't work the way the homestead movement, the Homestead Act, was expected to work, i.e., they didn't prove to be the everlasting farms. 160 acres on some of this Montana land, you know, is not going to be an everlasting farm, probably. They did not prove to be the everlasting yeoman farms of the dreams of the people who thought up the Homestead Act. That's sort of the emotional push, I think, behind homesteading. We're going to talk a bit more about that as I get into reading from the book. Besides those of us here from the homestead families and whatever pictures and other paper we may have, the remnants, and the land itself, of course, the remnants of homesteading are paper, paperwork. And any of us frustrated with how things go today with working with the government should be reminded, I think, of two things. First, that all that so-called red tape isn't new. And secondly, sometimes it maybe is necessary. And I won't defend that all the way on homesteading, but looking at the paperwork of homesteading, by God, it's at least orderly. And that's not bad in a government. I do have to say, that is not bad at all. Let me mention just briefly the background, the paperwork background of homesteading. It comes, a lot of it comes out, of course, of the Homestead Act of 1862. The laws under which people homesteaded are so numerous and different and complicated, I'm not going to get into that, even if I was capable. I studied 3 years, not specifically on that topic, but 3 years at the University of Washington under one of the leading land historians of this country, and I learned just enough to know how damned hard it was to understand that stuff. But from the Homestead Act of 1862, the basic was the 160-acre homesteads on the surveyed public domain, filing fee of, I guess, $26 when you back in those early days, and for living on the land and improving it for 5 years, lo and behold, that 160 acres became yours. That's sort of the basic that went on with the homesteading. Beyond that is another very potent piece of law and paper. And that's the Land Ordinance of 1785, which gave us this rectangular survey system, which gave us the townships, the miles, the school sections. 6 mile square township as the basic survey unit. The importance of this, again, is orderliness. This began, if any of you have flown recently, all the way across this country. You know the country begins to change about the Ohio River, that our great linoleum squares out here began to go to hell, that there are other land systems in this country. If you fly over Louisiana, things start to get pie-shaped or wedge-shaped or something as to how they laid their lands out. And it's all a matter of law. According to what law the land was described by and taken up by. What the Land Ordinance 1785 was trying to and did conquer was the old system of English meets and bounds, boundaries by physical description, streams, trees, and so forth. That my land went down to the third cottonwood, you know, on Sheep Creek or whatever. Well, we all know what's going to happen to the banks of Sheep Creek eventually, and what's going to be the third cottonwood. And so Thomas Jefferson, among others, came up with that great grid crosshatch, that net of survey that went out across America from roughly the Ohio River westward. See, I don't know if I need to talk any more about that. Montanans probably know the basics of this very well. Simply, ranges were measured westward from principal meridians, townships measured from baselines, got within the township and then went down to the quarter sections. And so it imposed this grid system on the land as if streets and avenues had been put upon it. This had some, I can't get into this very much tonight, I think. This had, I think, some everlasting social and cultural effects. Certainly the fact of the school section brought into American history local schooling, local funding of schooling, democratic schooling. And I can see the effects of that even in my own family, that when my mother was growing up down in the Maasagat country, down between Ringling and White Sulphur. That little school at Maasagat had, I don't know, 8 or 10 students. My grandmother, who had only ever gone to as far as the third grade, was on the school board there. The place had its own school board, it had its own school, had its own school section someplace. And so this was a very important effect that came out of this rectangular survey. Straight lines, we're seeing some of the effect of straight lines and roads and linear thinking, I imagine, in the fact that of 10th Avenue South out here, in effect. As you know better than I do, how much of the commerce of Great Falls has moved out there? Is that for me?
Or?
No. No, okay. How much of the commerce of Great Falls has moved out there? I've been back to Great Falls to be on Norma's show 5 or 6 times to visit friends or whatever. I've been here a lot of times down through the years. This is the first time I have existed, except for being here and so forth, literally all my time on 10th Avenue South. The bookstore, functioning bookstores are now out there. Literally everything you need to be a visitor in Great Falls is out there now. Why? Road system. Let's see. Specific papers. I hope any of you interested in finding out about the past of homesteading, either your families or whatever, are aware that the paperwork ends up in one of our great institutions. And also, one of the things government can and should do, the National Archives and Records Service. When I was writing this House of Sky, trying to figure out what went on with the Doigs when they were homesteading down there in the Big Belt, I wrote off to the National Archives and Records Service and got my grandfather's proving up papers for that homestead. About 65 pages across several years. Now, they charge you for photocopying, which is only fair, but and you have to provide them the, as I recall this, you have to provide them the legal description, the township range, the quarter section, and so forth. But the stuff was there. And the details there can sometimes be quite interesting. I found, for instance, that my grandparents homesteading there in the Turney Basin, 5,500 feet above sea level, sage everywhere. It's a bowl, it really is a basin-like thing. It's hard to find a place you're not standing cockeyed 1 foot higher than the other. Timber around, timber and sage and rock. That homestead was filed under the Desert Land Act. Way up there, which meant that my grandparents had to have a little ditch to prove irrigation. And so they irrigated a little hay meadow or something to prove up on that point of the homestead law. There's also the note along in the proving up papers, kind of written in a proud hand, as when my grandfather achieved a cattle shed built out of lumber rather than poles or logs or whatever. It was a long way to the nearest lumber from where they were. And so that, you know, that was a real achievement in the family. Maybe the most interesting use of homestead papers I've come across, at least before this book, was in a book Montanans begrudge me having written because it happens to take place on the Pacific coast instead of the Rocky Mountain front, but in Winter Brothers, looking at life on the Olympic Peninsula, the state of Washington, place I've hiked out to Cape Alava, out there, I was past a trail to an old homestead. Well, that turns out to be the farthest west homestead in the continental United States. Now, a guy named Lars Ahlstrom lived there. Indeed, I just missed him in life. I moved to Washington in the mid-60s, and Mr. Ahlstrom had, in his late 80s, I think, had cut his foot with an axe and had been taken into Port Angeles and died just a few years before. The cabin still existed. It existed a couple years ago when I was out there. It's deserted and falling down, and the rain and everything is taking it. But what interested me was this guy out there, he's only a mile and a half from the Pacific Ocean. Not much he could raise. Apparently did a little lumbering, logging and so forth to get by. But I got interested in him and writing Winter Brothers, and so I sent off to the National Archives for his papers. And here they came back with the kind of bonus you sometimes get from this paperwork. This society is belabored for being full of lawyers and lawsuits and depositions and so forth, but from my point of view, from a researcher's point of view, boy, the more lawsuits, the better, because people have to pin things down. Well, Lars Ahlstrom, by God, had an argument, a dispute with somebody who was trying to file a timber claim on his place. And so here was the court deposition by Lars. I, Lars Ahlstrom, being of sound mind, etc., have homesteaded here for umpteen years, and I offer proof in the fact that my domicile has these items. And there was an entire inventory of everything in his house, in his homestead cabin. You tell what kind of stove he had, you tell how many chairs he had, what kind of lamps he had. It was a time machine. Reading that, you were shot back into what he had in that cabin in about 1915. Now, you know, we all think we know what was in old places and so forth, but in actuality, it's very difficult to reconstruct an entire house, the entire furnishings of a place. And so I had the great good luck of that lawsuit. Moving ahead a bit here, some of the other paperwork that I found that applies, immigration guides. When I went to Scotland, when Carol and I went to Scotland to begin on Dancing at the Rascal Fair, I went to the libraries in Edinburgh and Glasgow, and here were various immigration guides telling you how to leave home in Scotland, how to get a ship across the Atlantic, how to get a train from New York westward, how to file on a homestead. And needless to say, because these things were promoted by immigration agents who had lodging or charged fees or whatever along the way, it looked like a pretty rosy prospect. And various people from Valier here tonight, I've looked at the early promotional literature of the Valier Water Project, and that too, you could not go wrong moving to what was about to become Valier in about 1908, 9, 10, somewhere there. It was a very highfalutin pamphlets and so on. And while Valier became a splendid place, which provided me high school, it would have had to have been something like Valhalla to live up to its promotional project, its promotional literature, I have to say. I think that's about enough talk out of me, because I'd rather hear your questions in a few minutes and find out what's specifically on your mind. Before I read, I would like to tell you, if you are interested in homesteading, that part of the Western past, there is a literature of homesteading. It's not particularly the fiction. There is a fictional and memoir literature, I should say, of American homesteading in the West. It's not particularly broad, but it is wondrously deep. I'll cite you three books, which I think make a marvelous family tree. And Hamlin Garland, one of the first of these, 19th century writer, son of the middle border, what his life was like growing up on, I guess, North Dakota, Midwestern type of homestead. Old Jewels by Mary Sandoz, story of her very difficult Swiss homesteader father in the sand hills of Nebraska. Marvelous book of the 1930s, looking back some years. And a great book, one of the really pivotal, eloquent books of Western history, not that much known, but it's by a guy whose name you'll all recognize, and I'm told he used to mow Charlie Russell's lawn here in Great Falls, a brief time he lived here, but Wallace Stegner, that great book, Wolf Willow. It's an odd book in that it contains memoir, essay, and fiction, all within one cover, and it probably cost him the Pulitzer Prize because they didn't know how to classify it. But it's a wonderful book about being on homesteads up here just across the Montana line into Canada. Okay, as if not a finale, at least an end, I wanted to read very briefly here from a bit to give you some notion of where I have come out of 3 years of thinking of Montana's first 30 years of as a state, which were primarily homestead years, and 3 years, my own 3 years of trying to think about this. As a fiction writer, I come out rather on I suppose, an emotional end of this. I am trying to show what was in the minds of my characters. But I did feel that I had to, because this book, I hope, will sell a few copies someplace besides Montana, I felt I did have to try explain homesteading a little bit. Dancing at the Rascal Fair, not many of you will be able to see this. It's probably the only work of fiction that ever had a township shown in it. And this is the 36 square miles of a township. And I did that for a reason. Some of you may know that how the numerations run. And let me explain that a bit. That, of course, the sections are numbered 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and then 7 is under 6, and it snakes back and forth across that way in the numeration. As you'll hear in the description I have contrived in here, this is called boustrophedon, and it's an old Greek word from the way they used to plow with oxes. They didn't go around the field. They went up the furrow and back down along the furrow and back and forth, and some of the early Greek language indeed was written that way, that the lines went like this, ended over here, went over here, ended over here, went back, which indeed is the way many of the word processors operate today. But this is called boustrophedon.